Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Unfiltered Coffee Podcast. I am Spencer Iadakatis, green buyer and head roaster for Peixoto Coffee.
Hey, guys, my name is Eddie Padilla. I'm a former store manager and coffee educator through Arizona Coffee Social. We are your hosts. In this podcast, we aim to catalyze conversations around coffee science, business, ethics, philosophy, culture, and tasting.
We are so thankful to have you, and now on to the show. Our guest today is Blair Smith, the general manager at Presta Coffee. Blair has had a long and storied career in coffee, starting with a position as a barista at Tarte Baking Company in Massachusetts, and then moving across country to work for Auggie's, where she would become the general manager. She also started her competition run with Auggie's starting in 2014 and has now competed at a national level or judged every year since. This conversation is packed with information about coffee shop management, Brewer's Cup, and how to brew a better cup of coffee.
Thanks for joining us. I feel like I've known you for a while now, or at least watched from afar. I feel like we've slowly collided more and more lately.
And now we're like same state, down the street almost, you know?
Yeah, it feels awesome. Amazing to have you in the community. So totally.
Here for sure.
Yeah, I'm totally excited to have you. I hope that once things open back up, we can do some community gathering type stuff and have you join in and show you around. But getting started on this, why don't you tell us how you got into coffee? What led you into specialty coffee and your background and all this?
So I actually have an art degree. I have my BFA from this tiny school in New Hampshire. It's called the New Hampshire Institute of Art. And I got out of school and, you know, they say that 1 out of every 100 people actually make a living in art with a degree. And I was like, oh, I'm going to be the one. And I think the only art I'm really doing right now is latte art, but that's fine. So getting out of school, I was like, okay, well, like, what do I know? What can I like just start working at? And I was in more of like the aquatics world at the time. So I was running a summer camp pool program. And then shortly after that, I moved to Western Mass and I got a job at the YMCA lifeguarding, teaching swim lessons, but mainly lifeguarding. Pretty basic, but definitely like just a good thing to like just jump into right out of school. But I was realizing very quickly that that was not enough to pay the bills. So I was like, okay, I need a second job. And I like scoured Craigslist and I found this really vague application for a cafe. And I was like, okay, cool. And, you know, it was all like prioritizing customer service, which at the time I was feeling kind of like my life was passing me by, just like watching other people swim. You know, I was like, I just go to work and I sit down and I just like watch other people have fun and there's like no joy. I'm like, my interactions with people are like to yell at them and correct them. Right. And so, I mean, I think that job gave me like a attention to detail, very observant and a good skill set to have, but it really lacked like human connection. And so I was really excited to start working at this cafe and it was really cool. It's Tarte Baking Company. They're still around there in Northampton, Massachusetts. And it's pretty much half coffee, half baking operation. At the time it was owned by Mukunda Feldman, who was also a cyclist. He owned about 6 cafes at the time, Northampton Coffee, Amherst Coffee, Greenfield Coffee, a couple shops in Boston. And he was using a roaster out of the Berkshires called Barrington Coffee. They've been around for a while since I think 1995. Yeah. So they're a larger operation, but still they've done a lot of farm direct trading and sourcing. And I feel like that was my gateway into specialty coffee. I mean, at the time I really had very limited interactions with coffee. You know, I was a broke art student, so I didn't really go to cafes. Like I was like, I don't need to spend money at a cafe. I can make coffee at home. So I was just buying like the cheapest pre-ground coffee from the grocery store and just like dumping a ton of hazelnut creamer. That was definitely my favorite. I love hazelnut creamer. Still to this day, that flavor is definitely like, it's like candy.
It is. I was the same when I started. It was all about that I don't know why that hazelnut creamer. Yeah.
It's like ice cream for me. I was like, vanilla's great, but hazelnut is, they got it down. So, you know, day one at this cafe, I'm learning like what a macchiato is. I'm drinking an espresso straight. I'm having a cappuccino, and we're learning about terroir and coffee processing and traditional drinks. And I'm just like, it's just caffeine overload and like information overload. And I'm like trying not to like go to the bathroom. Like it was very overwhelming, but I was very interested. And I actually like really enjoyed like learning a new skill in becoming a barista. And I felt at the time I was like, this is great. I mean, I was just so happy to be working on a really nice machine. We had a Synesso, and still to this day, I'm like, that machine felt like a Cadillac to me. Like it was my favorite part of the job was just working on that machine. So that's how I got my start in coffee.
Wow. Yeah. Going back to the art thing, what kind of art did you do?
I went to school for illustration and photography in a very traditional setting. So, you know, we're talking fine art background with traditional like oil paints, figure studies. And then even in the photography side of things, it was darkroom photography, manual printing, developing your own film. So just stuff that was just so incredibly expensive and beautiful, and just kind of like, you know, it had a real like purpose when I was in school, but trying to replicate that in real life outside of a studio is really, really difficult. So I definitely miss it, but.
Do you still dabble in it a little bit, or like different types or anything like that?
I have shot a few weddings as like a second shooter before, and I just didn't really like the commercial feel. It felt very like replicated. And I have done a few shows. I would kind of like schedule myself when I worked at Augie's to have a show for my paintings like every 2 years or so. So I would typically wait until like the last month before my art was to be up, and I would just like paint every day, and they were really successful. And I think if I had more time, I would maybe find a way to do more, but maybe I would find something else to do, but
yeah,
just kind of forcing myself to do that. Mm-hmm. Is basically it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Did you ever get to do any of the graphics while you were at Augie's, or like help them put together some of the graphic design that they did?
You know, I didn't. I feel like I'm much more like manual with my art. I don't like sitting in front of a computer and using the programs as much as I enjoy graphic design. And I really love strong like text images and design. I'm just like, I just would rather like paint something beautiful. I don't know.
Purist. Like that. That's awesome. There's not enough of people doing that anymore. I feel like it's like all moved digital. So no. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Very nice. Do you have any other hobbies outside of coffee?
Yeah, I would say like I'm definitely interested in cooking a lot. I like learning like new recipes and just kind of recreating the classics and keeping it really fresh and trying to like find ways of making healthy food taste good. I also really like baking, mainly pies for the most part. I really like baking pies. And then I'm just like kind of a dog nerd. I like watching dog obedience and training tutorials and also spending time with my dogs and like doing that. And then I guess cycling would be another hobby on the side, very low key. I went cycling with Curtis.
Oh God.
Last weekend. It went well for him, I think. I was dying, but you know, I was like, I went into it like, yeah, we'll go like 15 miles, you know, it's been a minute. And so we're, you know, 30 miles, we have a beer. I'm like, all right, well, I'm going to go home. Like, you know, I'm done. And I was like, go me, like 30 miles. Like that felt really good. And I get a text from Curtis later that night. And he's like, I'm just getting out of my kit now. I went for another 40. I'm like, what?
Wow.
He had 10 on me because of where he was meeting me.
That's crazy. Were you guys just doing like around the city or like gravel or anything? Or
no gravel for me, but we definitely like went on some of the trails, like the bike trails, which in certain parts were really busy with just like pedestrians or people walking the dogs and stuff like that. But it was cool. I haven't really explored a lot of the Tucson like bike paths, and I tend to avoid like just biking on the roads, you know, by chance that a car would be texting and driving, and yeah, you know, that's it. So
yeah, Arizona's really, at least up here, is notoriously bad with bike safety and all that. So I don't blame you at all. I had a couple questions going back. Favorite pie to bake? Need to know that.
I love strawberry rhubarb. I just like a classic cherry. Yeah. I think cherry is a strong one for me. I'm like, this is good. Yeah.
Nice. And then what kind of dog do you have?
I have a boxer. And then Alana has like a pit bull mix.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. So they get along.
They do. Yeah. They instigate each other, but Banks, Alana's dog, does this thing, which I've learned is like a sign of respect. And like, it's basically where he just like goes over to her and just to my dog and like licks the inside of her mouth, like her jowl, her lips. He'll like clean her eyes. He'll get her ears. And he just, it's like a respect thing. It's so weird, but.
My dog does that where he licks inside their ear, like my other dog's ear, forever, like an hour, where I just like, you gotta stop. Like, I can't listen to you do this anymore.
The sound like is so gross.
Yeah, it's terrible. So I found it interesting to find that you came from the East Coast. I actually didn't know that. How did you end up on the West Coast after all that?
So I had been with TART for almost 2 years and was kind of like moving up in management. And my ex at the time had gotten a really great job opportunity in Redlands, California. And I was like, well, you know, I'm gonna go scope it out like before I just give up this like pretty big opportunity at the time. And I met Austin. I met one of the baristas there and it just seemed like a really great space. And, you know, we just decided to keep in contact and I gave it like, I think a couple months and eventually moved out March of 2014. Yeah. So I had a job like the next week there, you know, pretty much ever since.
Is that Augie's at a one cafe size or were they bigger? Two cafes at that point?
Yeah, the Riverside location, they had opened in October of that year. So that was only like 6 months in.
Cool.
Yeah, wow. I know. So it kind of feels like, you know, not right where I started with Augie's, but where I'm starting at Presta is kind of the size, which it kind of feels nice to work with a group that small. It's like very intimate and a little bit more hands-on, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think that's around the size of my shop right now. We're at one, moving into two, so maybe even a little bit before that. But it's amazing to feel like you know everyone that works there and know what everyone's doing and everyone's really close. So it's cool.
It's interesting too, like how different spaces attract different customer bases and how sometimes there's overlap, sometimes there's not, you know, but just kind of, you know, whether it be students or, you know, professionals, like just like experiencing different patterns and like kind of tapping into those is kind of cool.
Yeah, definitely. Even different times of the day. It's like totally different kinds of people that come in. Yeah,
definitely.
So I had one last question in this kind of area, and I think we're going to kind of dive into like your competition stuff and everything behind that. But I was just kind of wondering what the different roles that you've done in the past. So like, I know you've managed a little bit. I'm sure you've done trainings. You said you haven't done any roasting, anything like that. So just like, what kind of roles have you filled?
Yeah, it's definitely mainly managing heavy. At TART, I was doing a little bit of training, but I just didn't have as much time to be, you know, a trainer at Augie's. It was more like, you know, running the busy store and then eventually taking on more of like a general manager role. And that's kind of where I left it. But, you know, I just kind of dabbled wherever really was needed. So like, you know, there were times where I was leading tastings and public cuppings and staff cuppings and things like that. Just trying to like get people inspired to learn more about the coffee and kind of like learn more about training their palate and things like that. But yeah, mainly managing, which I think, you know, when you kind of hit your groove and you can kind of like find your stride and take a lot of ownership and pride in that, I think it's a good thing. I think for the most part, I've seen kind of the downside of management in our industry. And that really kind of ties into this idea that, you know, a manager leaves and then it's like, okay, your best barista takes over, right? And so that's not, to me, really what makes a good manager. You know, you can be a really good barista, but you can be a really bad manager. And I feel like I definitely challenge myself to be both. And I think I've gotten there. And I just think like communication is really important, and kind of understanding that there are different types of personalities and different levels to just deal with on a regular basis. Management is hard. It's definitely like what you make of it. You could be always like striving for, you know, the growth of your store, the growth of your staff, but you really have to separate, in my opinion, from being everyone's best friend. You know, that's, they don't really want, and you shouldn't really want to have hard conversations around a friendship. That's when it can kind of get a little bit gray. And I've definitely learned that lesson the hard way to know now that like, that's a boundary, you know, but you know, just kind of having respect on both sides and being communicative and learning new ways to like make systems in the store and how things can be efficient, how things can be better for everyone, for the customer, for staff, things like that. So I just feel like in terms of hospitality, that's like really my focus. I'm always trying to like kind of get under people's skin and like understand what they're looking for out of like a space. Like, what are they looking for out of specialty coffee? You know, cause like there is definitely like a lot of shops popping up and they have like beautiful aesthetics and beautiful coffees, but it's just like, what experience are you giving them? What experience should they expect? And then how you can replicate that, I think, is just kind of like something I've been turning around in my brain for the last like 8 years.
Wow.
Sorry, that was kind of...
No, I love that. There were so many things there. I'd be really interested if you have any examples about things that you found that customers are looking for that you've like then created in the cafe or brought into the cafe.
Yeah, I think, you know, you always see like kind of two sides of like hospitality where like you end up being like exhausting yourself emotionally because you're trying to like be somebody's therapist at the register, and that can be a little bit long-winded. But I think like it's really important to guide somebody correctly through your menu. I think asking like kind of having a series of questions, right? Like you know, it sucks if somebody is like just coming into your store and they're staring at the menu and the barista is just staring at them, staring at the menu. You know, take a moment and say, you know, are you looking for something hot or iced? You know, just start engaging. Like, don't leave them to just figure out the menu. Like, maybe like throw some of your favorites, throw some recommendations, but like have a baseline of like, what are they looking for? You know, don't just judge based off appearance or just, you know, what you like. What I like is black coffee. Yeah. That's it. I mean, but I love selling lattes. I love selling matchas. I love selling espresso and tonics and good cold brew. You know, it's just like there's a whole audience for that. And it's also kind of understanding like when to speed things up. Like, I think pacing is really important as just like good delivery, right? So you don't want somebody to feel rushed, right? But also, you know, you are in control of the interaction. So if, you know, somebody's kind of taking up a lot of your time and there's a line forming, you know, you need to train your staff to be like, it was really nice chatting with you. Is there anything else I can get for you? You know, just being really kind about your delivery, but also like kind of giving them a cue, you know, or just anything. You're in control of the interaction. And I think it's important for people to feel empowered in that way.
Yeah, that's a hard thing to teach, I think, newer baristas too. It's one of those ones where it becomes like an intuition-based thing, I think, for a lot of people after they've been in the industry for a while. But every time we hire someone in new or something, you see them just like kind of do that stare like you were talking about and just like, you can say it, you know, start guiding them through. It's like, this is your chance. It's your time to do it.
It's also, I mean, it's difficult to kind of train hospitality, you know? So I feel like in hiring people, like, it's sometimes less about experience, but more about personality and like your own experience with customer service. Like, do you like talking to people? Are you nervous? Are you, you know, moody? Like, you're expected really as a barista to be hospitable, and there's a baseline for that, you know, but also too, as a manager, you have to lead by example. You know, you have to be professional. You have to be very like cautious of like your interactions with people and how they can affect other people around you. You know, if you're not there, show them like a good example of like how to deal with bad customers, how to deal with, you know, a drink sent back, like anything. So,
yeah, totally agree. Yeah. I think we're going to kind of start asking a lot of questions in the Brewers Cup area. So to kind of set this up a little bit, I think that you may be one of the people with the most experience in Brewers Cup. I'm not sure if there's like a ranking of how many times people have gotten into nationals or how many times people have done qualifiers, but I know that you would definitely be up high on that list. So how many times have you competed? I know I've watched 3 or 4 of your competitions myself, but I know you've done it a lot more. So do you have a number?
I think like kind of explaining like the number is what I'm going to do. So in, you know, the fall of 2014, leading into the 2015 year was when I started at the regional level and I took second place that year. It was the year that Sarah Anderson took first at nationals. And then, so that's one. And then went to nationals, that's two. Then the following year was the 2016 year and did another regional and I think a semi-national and then a national that year. There was a year, I think that was 2016 where they did the qualifying competitions. It used to be broken up by region.
Oh yeah.
And then it was national. And then I think they did one semi-national. Yeah. So I think it was like basically two a year. And then in 2018, it started being like one regional, one qualifier, and then one national. Mm-hmm. So 2016 and 2015, I competed both at the regional and then national level. And then 2017, the bracket filled up really quickly. And so I decided to judge. And that was great for me, my palate development and just really understanding the competition from a different side, obviously. So I judged both the qualifier and the national that year, which is awesome. Definitely recommend judging. We need good Brewers Cup judges and it's just a lot of fun. It truly is like a lot of fun. And then in 2018, I competed. I made it to nationals every time.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember 2020 was crazy. So I'm just like kind of, but I stopped, I think in 2019 and I said, I can't compete this year. Like I think my head was just not in it. I had too much on my plate. I just felt like I just needed like a year to myself, you know? So I judged that year again and it was great. And I feel like that's kind of where I was at. My last 2019, I think was actually my last competition, if I remember right. I was going through, you know, a tough time with my personal life and it was just totally in my head and it showed at nationals. And I was so just like, not there. Yeah. I went over time. I had never gone over time. Yeah. I was just like, wait, that's the time. Like, you learn these tricks of like keeping a timer on your table. So, you know, never to do that. You cut it off, you know? Yeah. And I just like, I slowed it down and I just over time and I was like, wow. So 2020, I think, or just leading into 2020, because it obviously didn't really finish, but did get to judge, which was awesome. And just felt better about that role. So I think going forward, I would go back to competing just because I still love it. And I feel like I can't go out like that, you know, going from like placing in the top 6 to then 7th the next year. And then, you know, just in the bottom of the whole bracket that last year was just, I can't stay down there, you know?
Yeah. You gotta redeem yourself now.
But I do I do think that on the national level, like on any given day, it's anybody's game. You know, if you're on it and your coffee's performing and all the stars align, there are some really good coffees. There are some really good brewers and anyone can take it.
For sure. So nationals, 5-6 times, something for you.
Yeah.
Around there. I'm going to first, I actually realized that we should probably explain what Brewers Cup is. So
yeah.
If you want to maybe just kind of go over what Brewers Cup is for someone that's maybe never heard of that, and then we'll start getting into the details on it.
Yeah. So it's, to me, it's such a like purist competition, right? So it's not about like as much showmanship as it's very technical. You essentially are being scored on how well your coffee tastes in a bunch of categories. There are two parts to the competition that determine your final score. And the first part is a really like leveling part, and that's the compulsory round. Everyone gets the same coffee. It has to meet a certain score to be given out. Like they can't just give you like, you know, below specialty or just, you know, something crazy. It has to be a wash coffee. It's got to be within 7 days off roast. So there's a lot of rules involving that, but basically you have essentially 45 minutes with this coffee. Everyone has the same equipment. That would mean your grinder, your water source. You are totally allowed to use your own brewing devices. They just have to meet the parameters. They have to be manual, things like that. You have to do 3 separate brews and get them on a table in 45 minutes, which it sounds like that's a lot of time, but it goes by extremely quickly, especially with a coffee that you're just experiencing. And to do 3 identical brews is something that I think I struggle with the most, because it's all mechanics and you're a human and sometimes that can be a little bit tricky.
And this coffee's not the best coffee in the world, right? Like this isn't a normal coffee that you'd be brewing in a cafe for the most part.
Some are fine. Some are, you know, something that you would really like want in a blend. You know, it's like that level. It's not anything really, really rough. It's really like just something I'm usually like not familiar with, you know.
Yeah.
But it's doable for sure. And then the second half of the competition is your open service, which everyone has 10 minutes to give a presentation, kind of like walking the judges through, you know, what the coffee is that you're serving and maybe how you are brewing it, how you are grinding it, how you are choosing which device to brew it on, the flavors they're going to experience. And that kind of walks them through not just like 1 or 2 notes, but it can be, I've seen people give out like 30 different flavors, and that's like descriptors on the tactile experience, the aftertaste, the balance of the coffee, the acidity, and the changes that the coffee has through hot and cold temperatures. So it's a very in-depth presentation, and 10 minutes it's pretty short for 3 minutes. And they're evaluating the aroma and then of course your presentation and your flavors. So that's like a different ranking. And of course, Brewers Cup has been kind of known to be nicknamed a coffee sourcing competition, but the combination of the two scores is really a way to determine a really solid winner, in my opinion. I think you can have the best coffee, but if you don't know how to brew a compulsory coffee good, you're not going to win. You know, you just see usually the top 6 having really high compulsory scores, which is how it should be. Even, you know, nobody likes compulsory, but it's all need to practice more at it, you know?
It's probably the most like fair part of it, right? Like it definitely needs to be in there to balance out any like crazy oddities, like some person's coffee's just through the roof, you know, 1 year or something like that. So they still have to be a good brewer to make it through, which I always like that part of it.
Yeah, I do too. As much as I find difficulty in it, I feel like it's a really like smart way to showcase the true intent of the competition. And I have a lot of respect for that part of it. So
yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Thanks for that. That was a great overview. Eddie, do you want to lead in there?
Yeah. So I know quite a bit of baristas that kind of want to get into competition, but they don't know really where to start. So what would you recommend they start? Like, should they start by going and watching some competitions, or maybe reach out to like past competitors, or how would you say they should start to go about this?
I mean, I think the best way is exactly like what you said, is watching competitions, like getting ideas of like, okay, what are ratios maybe that people are using? What are coffees that people are using? What are some techniques they might be using, you know, in terms of how they're grinding, if they're sifting their coffee, like, are they letting it bloom like for a minute? You know, just sometimes you'll find like a lot of interesting ideas that you might not have thought of, or you've written off, or you've been told that's absolutely not how you make coffee. And so it's fun to experiment, but I think like watching and learning from others is really important. And I think it's just like cooking. It's kind of like trial, right? Like I think for my approach, it's like, I'm going to isolate variables and just kind of chip away at this coffee. Right. And so if I'm practicing for, you know, the open service part of the competition, it might be, how does this coffee taste off roast each day? So maybe I'm cupping and just like having a baseline for that and seeing like when that coffee pops, like maybe we're trying different roasts and seeing what we're bringing out in the acidity, in the body, in the aftertaste, like what in the competition is ranked most important, you know? But I think, you know, you can ask somebody, a past competitor, but everyone's busy. I think, you know, to think that you're going to like be handed something in terms of like doing work in replacement of doing work and like understanding the coffee, I think you're not going to find enough value in having a conversation where you could really get more from like your world brewers champions, your national brewers champions, and like watching those routines and even like picking up small things that they might be doing in their presentation. You know, like I mentioned, like putting a timer on your table. Like I saw that in a routine. I was like, doing that, that's brilliant. You know, it's just like a little trick that nobody would really think to tell me to do. Yeah. You know, but maybe I saw it and I'm like, okay.
Yeah. So also another obstacle I think is competition can be super expensive. So what about on this? Like, would you talk to your employer? Like if you're working at a shop, do you talk to them and say, hey, I want to compete. Do you have any like availability where you can sponsor me or something like that? Do you take that approach or what do you do?
Yeah. I mean, I remember like talking to other people about this. You know, there are some shops that are just like, it's just not in the budget. It's not really anything I'm looking for. You know, maybe like you're a multi-roaster and you're not really connected to the roasting side of things. So sponsoring competitors is not really going to put yourself on the map, you know, but for roasters, I think it actually highlights their coffee. So you can kind of spin it to the advantage of it's marketing. I mean, it is, you are representing this company. And if you do well, you are bringing knowledge back to your team. You are bringing expertise for your customers. Like it's a win-win. I have a lot of customers that like, once I talk a little bit about competition, they're like, oh my gosh, like I'm being served this coffee from a competitor. Like it's just a game changer. So I feel like if there is a conversation to be had with your employer about if it's worth it to compete, I think absolutely, like your reputation is going to go up and you're going to be known for that. Whether you win or lose, like just the fact that like you are going through the process and learning along the way is something really unique. And I think even like in your community is very well respected and received.
Yeah.
It is very expensive, I will say. And I really appreciate the different sponsors that help people out. I know Glitter Cat is huge on being able to reach a more diverse group of baristas that want to get into it and give them a chance. And I think that's really, really useful for a lot of people that can't and normally wouldn't be able to. So
yeah, they're amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. So I actually kind of want to take this back a little bit. So what made you first start in Brewers Cup? Was Augie's already like big competitors, or is this something that you saw and you just wanted to do? Like, explain to me how like you first got into all this.
I had a friend that was competing in the barista championship, and I had watched her kind of like go through her routine without any help from her employer. So understanding like the seriousness and kind of getting like a look into it was really cool. And then when I started at Augie's that year, they were doing the regionals in Palm Springs, and Austin was like, I want to compete. you know, that would be a lot of fun. And I was like, well, do you have anyone yet? Like, you know, I was like, you know, I had seen the barista competition. I think I have a lot of respect for it, but it's just not as interesting to me or as nerdy as the Brewers Cup. And I kind of was like, no, I don't want to like do milk drinks. I want to do black coffee because that's what I like. And it's what I want to be drinking all the time. So I felt more attached to that. And I was like, yeah, I would love to compete for you. And so that's just kind of how the conversation went.
Nice. That's awesome that you were supportive in that.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. Back then it's not nearly as big as it is now. So that's cool that you guys got in early on. You got to do a lot of the experience, got a lot of early experience in that. So I was kind of wondering if you could walk us through like your training process for one of these competitions, like how much time or how many days a week do you put in? How much time in general do you start like months and months before working on it? Or is this like a month long, 2 month long process for you? And then what are the kind of things you focus on?
Sure. So I think it actually depends on what stage in the competition. At this point, I feel really comfortable at the regional level because I know what they're looking for. And I know that it's a little bit more of a leveling competition at that level as well. So if you don't know, the like regionals at this point are considered qualifying competitions. It's a little simpler in that you brew two instead of three coffees. You get to cup the day before and pick coffee off the table. There's a few coffees that you can choose and then go from there. You only have like a bag, a 12-ounce bag to use. So it's much like the compulsory round, but you still have to talk and give a presentation. So it's kind of like a hybrid of both. So I feel like at this level for me, training looks a little bit different early on. I feel like I can lean into my experience of like, okay, I know I want to talk about this. I know I want to approach it this way, you know, but towards the like national level, it's much more focused on like this coffee. First, it's selecting a coffee. And I think that's the hardest for me because I'm like, maybe the right one is just around the corner, you know, like, so just kind of finding one that stands out, I think is important. Also is going to perform well, like isn't going to be temperamental. Like I've had some coffees that just, they fall really flat day of and you're like, oh my God, this coffee is so much better than this, you know? And so really understanding the coffee is very important, but it's a lot of time. I think the time commitment is huge, much more so than financial is concerned. Like I'm used to working like an 8-hour shift and then spending 4 hours at the warehouse, like just cupping the coffee, brewing the coffee, writing notes, like, and then as it's getting closer, and that might be a month and a half out, 2 months out. And then as it gets closer, it's like, okay, making choices. Like now we're going to like fine tune things. Like we're going to write the speech. We're going to edit the speech. And maybe it's like a skeleton to start. Like this is where I'm going to talk about this and this and this and this. And I can kind of like get it to a point where I just kind of fill in the blanks. So it's like, okay, brewer, this, why did I choose that? Because this, this, and this, it highlights this, you know? And then maybe my grind, you know, I found that this allowed this, you know? And it's just explaining how you got certain results, you know? I think water chemistry is now huge. People are getting really into making their own water, which I really enjoyed. And that was something that I wanted to do for a long time because I've had the experience of getting to whatever city you're in using the sponsor water. And it's just like, it's completely different. Terrible. I've like brought my own water and like in gallon jugs, you know, things like that. And like, then you're limited to, well, am I able to like practice or should I save that for the day of, you know? So there's a ton with water and that's like, I think one of the more important factors of the routine. And so, I mean, the last like 3 weeks leading up to it, it's like mechanics. And that's like, they're looking at how many pulses in each one. Are you hitting them at the same time? So, okay, I went three circles and poured 30 grams in this one. But then in this middle one, I'm pouring 100 grams with five circles. Like they're gonna mark you down on that. So it's really, it's not just about watching your bed and kind of like you're in and you're out and your time. It's more like, is it the same? And if it's not, why? Did you explain why? If not, like they're going to dock you. So mechanics is really important. I tend to like have run throughs early on even if it's just like being comfortable talking about the coffee, even if it's just like figuring out how I need to like run the mechanics of it. Do I pick up this kettle at this time? Am I like timing this right? And if I'm like recording it, I can play it back, look at it, see where I can improve. So it's a lot of just back and forth like that. And then if you have like a hiccup where your coffee doesn't come in time and you're waiting on it, like that's the most scary thing. And that's happened to me before, but you just have to be prepared for stuff like that. And I think I've talked to other competitors, their coffee came in 3 days before the competition. It's like, they bang it out and they do a great job. And I'm like, but I think training looks differently for everyone. I think there are competitors. I know there are some competitors that they might have like a little bit more of a role where they can step aside and like spend the time day in and day out. And I try to get at that level, but in reality, I've always been on hourly working in a shop 5 days a week. And so it's like, it's a good learning experience to like challenge yourself, but it is, I mean, it's a lot of work, and some people are able to do it in less time with less, you know, I've had coworkers that just, you know, practice once or twice and they kill it, you know? And I'm just like, man, I wish that was me. I just have to like chip away at it every day. And like, to really feel like I mastered it, you know, I can't, it shows to me, I can't fake it, you know, but.
Now, when it comes to like training and competition, is it literally just you in the warehouse, like cupping, brewing, or is there like people helping you, or is it just you by yourself?
I've had the extreme privilege of having both the roaster, Tim, at the time from Augie's, and the owner, Austin, be there a lot to try my coffee. And, you know, it's in passing. It's not always like, hey, like, sit here with me and let's talk about this. Like some of it is just like, do you like this one more than this one or this one? You know, like try this. Do you get this note? And like flavor calls are huge. So agreeing on a flavor call, just being like collaborative, if that's a word, on really getting down what this coffee tastes like. Because sometimes with, especially I think with the newer, more anaerobic, more unique processing, they change quickly. You know, it's different days are giving you different tasting notes. And even like, you know, one day it might be like a Meyer lemon. And then the next day it might be more like a mandarin orange, you know, but it's still citrus. And so just kind of like honing in and kind of trying to catch it even through the transitions of hot and cold are important. But yeah, I think having someone there that you respect to taste your coffee is the most important part of your training. And also hearing feedback, I think is huge. I think going to art school helped me. And, you know, you're putting yourself out there when you're up for critique, like several times a week, you put a piece up and you have everyone tear it apart, you know, verbally. And so it's kind of being able to assess things very critically, but in competition, that's, you know, you can't be attached to what you made in that way. Like you have to be able to say like, yeah, you're right. It is over-extracted or the body is really thin. You have to like pull yourself away as a person and not take it personally if something doesn't taste right, just to move forward. So having a team there that can do that for you, it's, you know, it's more about finding what works and what doesn't than like, I think what more is generally thought of as coaching, you know?
Yeah. Now, do you have like that support, like day of competition or are there some competitions where you don't really have support and it's just you, or how does that kind of work?
There's definitely been years where some like two competitors might be going on at the same time. So it's just like, hey, you got this? Yeah, I got this. Just let's iron out my tasting notes. But usually there's somebody there, and you know, with Tim and Austin, they were like most often there, if not always. And we would always have this like, you know, I'd be mic'd up with my cart and, you know, they're like, all right, Blair, like kill it. And I'd be like, all right, well, see you on the other side. And we always see you on the other side of this kind of vibe going, which was great. And just definitely having like a good relationship with the both of them and having them be my support was crucial. So very grateful for that.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I was kind of wondering on the mechanic side, you were talking about how important that is. And that seems to be where a lot of people
lose a lot of points and don't really know that they're losing points from what I've observed. I'm kind of wondering what the main things that you focus on here in the mechanics, and which things do you think people overlook often that can just score you easy points or help you out a lot?
I think there are really a lot of advantages to simplifying your brew, to saying like, okay, if I do this and it seems really like important that I stir the bed and then I pick up the brewer and like set it down, you know, like, is it making a difference? And weighing that difference, because day of, you're going to be nervous. You might not remember to do it. So like being very intentional on your movement is huge. And I think, you know, less so than losing points, your brews are going to be inconsistent. And you're going to notice, like, if you hit the coffee bed on brew number one 4 times and then 6 times on number two, the timing might be off, you know, your extraction might taste different. So your flavor notes are going to be off. So kind of dialing in, almost like how we're taught to brew espresso, right? Okay, if you're going to groom the basket, groom it every time, groom it the same way, tamp every time, tamp the same way. You know, it's the same. Like, you want to dial into what tastes good and what you can easily replicate every single time. So I, for instance, like my first competition, I decided to use the Chemex cone, which was insane. But
there's the time.
Yeah, everyone's never going to do well. That thing is so bad. You know, I got this. I can make it. And I did really well with it. I came in second in the regional and I was like, wow, yeah, I did it. But I knew in the back of my mind, I was like, okay, I have to talk and pour. You know, I think a lot of baristas are so used to being like very like head down in their work. And so in competition, you have to be heads up, smiling, giving a great personality, explaining the same sorts of things that like the person on register would normally be doing, you know, really like selling it. So for the first competition I ever did, I was like, okay, well, I'm going to do one where I only have to like hold it and let it pour in the middle. And that's what I did, because I knew I needed a really gentle agitation and I knew I wasn't going to be pulsing. It was just a continuous pour. And I was like, yep, that's what I'm doing. Like, So I made it really easy for myself, you know, and it wasn't because I was like lazy. It was intentional. I picked a brewer because of that. So you can make choices and make it work for you if that's something that you have trouble with. And I think another example is I used the Mellow Drip. My first time using the Mellow Drip, I had a really great rapport with Ray Murakawa from Mellow. And he built these like Mellow Drips that were stationary that could sit right on top of your brewer. So instead of me two-handing everything, you know, just sat it down and just poured on top of that. So it's like, not only did that enhance the coffee for a number of reasons, but it helped with the mechanics of having to do 3 coffees the same way.
It kind of is also the reason why these triple kettles and like all interconnected kettles have kind of come into play, right? Because it just takes all the mistakes out of the way. It's not necessarily about making the coffee better, but more minimizing the mistakes that you can make.
Yeah. There are some people that, you know, I watch them and they're like absolutely perfect and they're doing all these crazy things and they're like a really intricate ballet. And I'm like, wow, this is just crazy to watch. It's so just effortless, you know, but I'm not going to say like clumsy, but just right there, you know, like I need to be sure that I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. So would you say like get as complicated as the coffee demands and don't try to like dress this like routine up just to make it look, you know, like fancy and different?
Oh, totally. I mean, there are a lot of people that think that they need to reinvent the wheel in order to like stand out in their presentation. And it's like, well, it kind of needs to be backed up by the flavor, right? Like don't sift your coffee on stage. If you sift it backstage and you put it and it doesn't taste much different, you know what I mean? Like there's a lot of ways to simplify and I think the Brewer's Cup is a good example of how it's not about the theatrics. Like it's not really about doing all these like, flair, like moments of flair. Like it's really about like, okay, if I'm going to do that, it needs to have a reason and I need to be able to explain it in the cup. I think that's really what I enjoy about Brewer's Cup is like you can really focus on extracting that coffee well. And I think, to be honest with you, there is a lot more going on in the grind, the water, and the roast than necessarily in the mechanics of like trying to do a million like stirs. And you know what I mean? Like, it, a lot of these coffees are really good, and so you have to brew them very like intentionally.
Definitely.
Yeah. Do you think, you know, coming from the judging side, now that you've seen a lot of that, that there is significant amount of points that to be made in innovating in a new brewing method? So like, if you're judging someone and they came up with, you know, say like their own new brewer, totally different thing, not like your normal B60, and they brew you like an incredible cup with totally different balance, is that going to be worth it to take that step for them to do something brand new? Or is that not really show up in the points anywhere?
I've had examples of that where, you know, somebody's like 3D printed a brewer and I'm like, yeah, it tastes amazing, you know? And it's just like, I'm very impressed by that, because I think that shows the understanding, and that's important, you know, like being able to say like, I chose the diameter of this hole that the coffee flowed through, the depth of like how that filter sat on this brewer. You know what I mean? There's a lot of intent that people might be thinking of. I remember like making almost similar things to the Mellow Drip out of like shower head screens and being like, oh, I can taste the metal, you know? So I can't, and just scrapping it, right? So at that point it was like, okay, it's not worth it to reinvent the wheel here. Thankfully somebody came along and reinvented it. But, you know, I think if it makes sense for what you're trying to do, and if you have that kind of creative side of, I'm going to create the brewer, you know, like that's awesome. That is very impressive. But I also feel like you need to be understanding of the hierarchy of, am I able to execute this coffee, brew it well, or am I just spending all this time making the brewer? In which case, there's a lot of brewers out there that are wonderful and will highlight the coffee in a similar way, you know?
For sure.
So
I think this would be a good time to kind of walk through the different brewing variables and have you kind of quickly touch on how people should be thinking about them. So I thought maybe we could run through your last competition and maybe first start with, how did you decide the coffee you're going to use in the last competition?
So,
or any competition that you want to focus on, but whatever's easiest.
I mean, there have been times where I've been lucky enough to, I mean, my 2016 year was really like a pivotal point for me, because I had just the previous year cupped a table of La Palma EL Toucan, which now is a household name in our industry, which is amazing. At the time it was like, they were doing new stuff. I had never tasted Colombia the way that those tasted. And so I was like, wow, like meeting them at a cupping and then being able to like get their coffees the next year and use it and have like a really great conversation around what went into this coffee, then going to the farm, kind of having that full circle experience with the coffee brought that to my, you know, and every year after that I had used a La Palma, I used them for probably at least three or I think four conditions total, which I had done some like weird stuff. Like I froze some of their coffee and like saved it for a year, but having the understanding of that coffee year after year was really important for me. So I was able to like get faster at my answers, right? I knew I was looking for things like age off roast. I knew after working with that coffee the first year that a month out, that coffee still tastes amazing, if not better than that fresh within 2 weeks off roast, which is very unusual for a coffee. Usually like you start to lose some of the more nuanced flavors and some of the more unique characteristics, but I found that in their coffees, they balanced out and they became really sweet and very complex with a little age on them. So maybe it was just our roasting, but that's kind of where I found some like aha moments in like just getting a coffee, knowing like how it was going to perform and like really grabbing onto it and understanding it. My last competition, I had cupped some of the La Palmas and I didn't think they stood out enough. I felt like in a sea of La Palmas, like they were not going to stand out. So I felt like I wanted to pick something different. but it was getting scary. Like, we had no time. And Austin was like, I found the one. Me and you are going to use this coffee. And I'm like, all right, I trust you, you know? And it happened to be an anaerobic coffee, also from Colombia. It's called Red Plum. And it was like, he was like, it's crazy. I thought it was flavored. Like, it was so crazy. And I'm like, wow, cool. And I remember like Tim bringing it to the shop and was like, we bought this coffee. This is the last of it. Like, let's cup it right now. And we cupped it. And it was like, I don't know whether he ground it wrong or something, but I was like, I'm not tasting what you're tasting. Like, I'm not tasting this crazy. I'm trying to remember like some of the notes from that year, but it was just like strawberry hard candy and just like crazy chocolate and things like that. And I was like, yeah, I'm just not getting any of that. It just tastes good. You know, I was just like, this isn't the one. But I at that point, that was the one. That was what it was going to be. So, you know, waiting for that coffee to arrive, it's like, okay, like, let's think about, you know, at that point I was like, okay, I had really leaned into the Stag dripper as like my go-to dripper. I think being with the parameter of it being like a 10-minute brew time, like, I needed to go with something smaller, more fast brewing. Like, I can't have like a 6-minute brew on three coffees. It needs to be like 3:30, like max, you know? So I had decided I really liked the Stag dripper. I really like wanted to like work on that. And I felt really dialed into that coffee or that brewer. So I kind of knew, like, almost like as an espresso basket, you know, your range of like what's going to work, what's going to fit and like perform well, you know, like how to approach that brewer. So from there, it's like, okay, I got my coffee on the way. I got my brewer. Let's like play around with water chemistry. So maybe I took like a natural process coffee while I was waiting. And I just kind of like started with a baseline understanding of like, I did a ton of research on water and I was like, okay, I have like all these ingredients I'm going to use. I'm going to make these concentrates. I'm going to add these concentrates, like multiply them by 1,000, you know, whatever. It gets really, really specific, weighing everything out to like a 10th of a gram, you know, and even using like specific things to store the water in is important. I found that like some plastics kind of leach into the water and you like end up tasting it. So it gets really frustrating, but cupping different coffees with your water and like understanding like, okay, this is my control, my RO water that I know we cup our production roast on, it's delicious. And then using my coffee or my water and I'm cupping it blind and I'm saying, okay, well, which one's better? Why? What is this bringing out? You know, things like that. So then I'm building a routine around like where I went with my water, you know, kind of understanding what's being brought out, like calcium and body and, you know, magnesium and sweetness, like just things like that. And so when the coffee arrives, it's like, okay, let's try two really different approaches to the roast. And that's where Tim and I really had a lot of fun because it was like, okay, he's going to try one thing. We're going to cup it. We're going to talk about what we liked, what we didn't. He's going to try something else. And then we're going to cup both every single day off roast. And then we're going to try a third one, maybe like combine the two. Okay, well, which one is still better? Which notes are we like locking in and we're finding every day? Like just getting into the habit of like, we need to just like know this coffee like the back of our hand and knowing the different variables between like roast, water, grinder, and brewer, and then the routine and what makes. So that's kind of like the hierarchy really of like the most important variables to kind of mess around with. Obviously like ratio is huge, you know, understanding like, is this coffee like a really tight ratio? Does it like a little bit more of a spread out one? Something about like Tim's roast, like we really liked it like a 1:14. And I kind of knew that was, I would always try 1:15, 16, 17, always liked 1:14 better. The aftertaste always like improved as it cooled, like understanding where, I think the biggest takeaway from judging was like, how does that coffee cool? Is it like amazing in the first minute and then dead after that? Because that score is going to go down. That score is not going up. You need to make sure that that coffee cools beautifully. So.
Yeah, awesome. Have you ever tried with even lower ratios with those coffees? So did you go, I know some people brew like 1:12 ratios for nationals and stuff like that, which I always thought was wild.
You know, I have gone like 1 to 13 and a half, but I really, I don't know if I've ever gone like 1 to 12 or 1 to 11 or, you know.
Yeah, they're strong. I was like tasting some of those coffees back there. I was like, whoa, I haven't tasted like something like that in a long time. But it's good.
True about espresso.
Yeah.
You know, about like, I feel like the East Coast, the shots are much smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Higher ratios than the West Coast. It's all like big shots, you know.
So a little bit into the variables there. So what makes you like the Stag besides the fast brew times? Is there anything else that it's doing really well for you there?
Oh, totally. The biggest improvement, other than just being a flat bottom brewer that, you know, is really great for consistency and sweetness, is the walls of it. They're really thick. And so the brew is like really narrow in diameter, but the surrounding walls of the brewer itself is really like well insulated, so it retains heat really well. And I started thinking about, sometimes you have a coffee you're brewing as a pour over, you taste it, it's kind of flat, and then that same coffee you throw and you're like, all right, we gotta take it off the pour over bar, like let's just batch it, and then you have like one batch of it and you're like, wow, the aroma is crazy. The coffee is so sweet. And you're like, what's different in the FETCO or the Curtis Brewer than in a pour over that you like meticulously like took the time? And I think in reality, it's heat retention and like the humidity that happens inside that basket. So having like a mellow drip that's stationary, or, you know, having heat retention in the brewer, I think is really important to the aroma, to the body. I noticed, like, if you did a side-by-side with like, say a Kalita and a Stag, like I found the Stag had just way more complexity in the body and the way that coffee like went from hot to cold in the tactile experience. So I kind of leaned into that a lot in my routines because I enjoyed it. Like, well, this is different. Like this is like a much more like plush, silky body. Like that's something I want to highlight, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And then what about a grinder? So how are you actually looking at different grinders, or are you just kind of going with like what you know best in that one?
Yeah. I mean, I would love to like be able to like bring my grinder, you know, from place and have that as a control. But in reality, the EK just has way more consistent particle size that it has a great balance with the fines, in my opinion, to have like the complexity of the fines, but also you're not having huge boulders. I feel like a lot of the home grinders have huge boulders. And I mean, even I remember using like the Guatemala grinders, you know, those still, they hold a lot back. They're just not as precise as the EK, in my opinion. So it was always EK for me.
Yeah, I'm saying. Just wondering if there was, yeah, if you had played around or if that's just that's the way to go. And then I did want to hear a little bit about the Mellow Drip. So it sounds like you've been using that. You've been using it consistently throughout the whole brew. Or are you doing half full agitation, half Mellow Drip? Or like, how do you do that? And what do you think that brings to the cup for you?
I think there has to be a balance between just using your bare kettle and then using the Mellow Drip, because you'll find that you need a little bit more like agitation at some point in the brew to like increase the acidity. You know, if you wanted just a sweet cup, you could get that with the Mellow Drip the whole way through. But with competition in certain styles of coffee, like certain anaerobic coffees or delicate coffees, you know, it made sense to just kind of highlight a little bit of that agitation at the very like last pour versus at the very beginning. But I did definitely like take it through all the phases, you know, like, am I going to bloom it with the bare kettle? Am I not? Am I going to, you know, do midway half the brew, you know, just seeing what the coffee likes, you know, really is the answer. But Ray and I played around a lot in the early days of the Mellow Drip, and he kind of walked me through his approach. And I mean, he uses it obviously day in and day out. He conducts tons of experiments. I think Ray would be the best Brewers Cup competitor ever. He's just like so in tune with like getting different results and understanding the extraction, but he's a little shy, so he doesn't want to. But all that to say, his bloom technique is really interesting. He really recommends like a three-phase bloom, right? So in three parts. So if you're blooming like 45 grams, you know, 3/15s, and then waiting like 30 to 45 seconds before your pulse. And then he really talks a lot about using the little glass wand that it comes with to not necessarily like stir the bed, but to just poke and see if you find any dry pockets. And so I do that a lot at home. I think it's either a competition tool or it's a home tool. I don't necessarily see it as a, I'm going to bring this into the shop. You know, it's just, it's fun to like have the time for yourself to kind of nerd out, you know, but in a shop setting, it doesn't always make sense. However, when I use it at home, I'm definitely grabbing that wand and I'm like seeing around with it. But at the competition level, I won't, because having that extra step doesn't always make sense in the routine for the mechanics of it, for being able to replicate it. It to me would feel too much of a variable to play with, but it's just a really interesting tool and a really interesting approach, because you have to compensate your temperature. So it's made out of like some sort of plastic that's obviously food grade and everything, but you lose heat as it passes through, as more than you would think. You know, you're starting with a brood temperature really like 208, sometimes 209, you know, because you have to imagine that it's losing at least 4 degrees, you know.
I go on boiling a lot on that thing, using those things.
Do you like it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think you could do really unique things with those. I think you can brew cups that you really can't brew any other way with those. So there's some coffees and some brewing methods that when I want to highlight something, I think that only that can really do it the way I want. So yeah, I think it's an awesome tool to just have.
It's like really gentle. Yeah. You know, it's like introducing coffee to water without like being a full immersion method and allowing agitation and the direction of your pour to kind of be eliminated, you know, which is nice.
Yeah, I found actually I used the Gabby dripper a little bit too, which is a similar thing. And I found that I couldn't even get extractions high enough because it was so gentle. No matter what I did, it's highs, temperatures, super fine grind. I had to agitate like, or do bare kettle, as you said. There was no way to get, it was like 14% extractions no matter what. It was insane. Oh. Yeah. So a lot of people don't like that thing because I think they're trying to use it like the whole way and you just can't, there's no way to extract on it. It's insane. So, but it's cool. Once you figure it out, like it really, you can brew some cool stuff. And you can actually brew cups that are like 24, 25% extractions by doing that, because it's so gentle. Once you get that really heavy extraction in the beginning, you can do a really gentle second half. That's what I found, and actually get really high extractions that don't taste over extracted. So
you found
it's cool.
Gentle is in the second half. Use the device in the second half.
Yeah, so I found like if you go like a very fine grind on the EK, so like somewhere around like the 7 on the newer dials, like really fine, and you did like a bare kettle bloom and then a bare kettle like first pour, and then you put the dripper on for the second half, that first part you just get crazy heavy extraction, like so much. And then the second half you can still get the rest. It kind of just pulls everything else through really gently, and you can, yeah, I was getting like 24-25% extractions, and they're nice. It was impressive. Like, so I think there's some cool things you could do there, but you can't use it in shops. Like, it's impossible to like replicate in volume or anything. So it's unfortunate that way.
Yeah.
Good for competition too.
Yeah.
And then a couple more on variables. So do you have a kettle do you find kettles help you in any way? Or now that you're using Mellow Drip, maybe not so much on that one?
I mean, I like the Fellow because it ergonomically feels really nice in your hand. Like I remember picking it up for the first time and I was like, I was so used to, I had this one competition kettle for a long time and it was a huge 1.7 liter box. Okay. And it was awesome because I could use one kettle for the whole thing, you know, which is awesome. I didn't need two kettles, just the one big one, you know? So that was really great, but it's a lot on your wrist to pouring for hours and hours practice time. And then I was like using two hands. Like I have bird wrists. Like there's no way that I was holding a 1.7 with just one hand. So the fellow kettles are really nice in that way of having a nice balance for your wrist. I know a lot of people were into using flow restrictors, but I found that you really didn't need to with those kettles. And the fact that you can just set it down and it's set to the temperature. You don't have to keep pushing a button. I mean, just little tiny things like that make a huge difference in competition.
Sure. Yeah, the weight thing. We actually just talked to the fellow CEO on our last podcast. And I told him that I was like, you just got the weight so right. Like it just feels so good in your hand compared to all the old ones. Yeah, those 1.75s, I can't believe you did that because that breaks my little wrist too.
I mean, I like a raffle and I was like so proud of it. I was like, I rarely use it at home. And so I was like, let me just use it for competition. So
that's amazing. I love that. And then I think the last thing I had in this variable section is cupware. Do you find that certain cupware really enhances your coffees or is that just more on the aesthetic side?
I think it's really aesthetic, but I will say something that I took a cue from a world competition that I found was actually really helpful in kind of gaining a little bit of an edge was instructing them on using the spoon to evaluate certain aspects of the cup and then using just evaluating by the cup itself. So, you know, when you sip directly from a cup, you're getting a different tactile experience. You're experiencing the body of that coffee completely differently than off a spoon. And I always felt that the spoon was really great for like acidity and flavor, but aftertaste and body was just really lacking unless you really nailed it. But if you have them sip from the side of whatever vessel you're serving in, they're going to experience what you're hoping for them to experience. So I often did that in competition, but as far as ceramic cupware, I think something that, you know, is a little bit more open because you want the coffee to cool somewhat quickly because yeah, in a perfect world, like the judges can take 20 minutes to really like follow that coffee, but also like there's only a certain amount of volume, like they need it to cool in a certain amount of time. So having them have a vessel that might've been a little bit stubbier and more open, thinner walls, like kind of help that along. So that's kind of my thoughts on that.
Yeah, I would agree. The body evaluation out of the cup is wildly different. I mean, that's definitely where the body's at. I also feel like a cup that can go over your nose. I feel like it has to be wide enough to go over your nose so you get aromas. I feel like that actually helps, but that's about the only thing I see with ceramics. So I was wondering if you had anything extra there. So thanks for that.
With the aroma, I was much more intentional about having them like not only just smell from the decanter itself, but to like actually swirl it and like release the aroma. You know, like I felt like having it trapped in the decanter was for me the best representation of aroma. Cause in a cup, sometimes you miss it. Cause in brewer's cup, you evaluate the aroma first, you get your point, your note, whatever, and you move on. You never really like throughout the brew, you're not thinking about the aroma anymore. Yeah. So that's the first thing that you get down on your score sheet. So for me, it was like, here's my decanter, like, you know, please swirl it and then set it back. I'll pour for you. You know, sometimes that worked and I had a routine where I completely forgot to pour the coffee after that. And that's when I took seventh and I was like, damn.
Yeah, for sure.
So you've obviously been a successful, you know, brewer competitor. You've been doing it for a while. Do you think you've brewed the perfect cup of coffee or it's something that you just think it's unattainable? You're constantly trying new things. Is that something you're doing right now? Like, are you constantly trying new things, new brewing methods, new theories, stuff like that?
I would say it's like very passive right now. Like I'm not like actively like, all right, I'm going to schedule myself to do this, this, and this. But I do, sometimes I'm like, oh, I'm going to try something crazy, you know, and like, I'll just do it at home. But I don't think I've brewed myself the best cup of coffee because I've, as a judge, I've had some coffees that I've been like, just like jaw to the floor because I've been like, holy shit, I feel like I am looking through glass at the coffee's flavor on a chart. Like that's how crisp clear it appears. Like, I remember having, I forget the competitor's name, I feel badly, but they made it in the top six last year. They had this coffee and it was like just so candied and it was so aromatic. It had such a fragrance on it and it had like just absolute like clarity in all caps. Like, and you know, he did some like weird things, which I don't want to give his secrets away, but I remember having that coffee and I'm like, I wish I could brew coffee like this. Mm-hmm. Like this is like, it's a totally different experience. Like the tactile was crazy. The fruits were like, I was biting into all these like beautiful fruits. Like it just, it wasn't muddled in any way. It was just so clear. So I've had a few cups like that from competitors where I'm like, yeah, there's still something for me to learn. There's still something for me to aspire to. I think that's like also a really good reason to judge. Like you, yeah, you might think that you know how to brew great coffee, but then you experience like a coffee like that and you're like, it's not just about the coffee anymore. That brew was incredible. So, yeah.
Do you remember what coffee that was by chance, where it came from?
I think it was Rwanda.
Really? That's even more interesting.
Yeah.
Natural or wash?
Natural.
Awesome. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That makes me want.
Don't quote me on it, but.
It's going on the Instagram.
I remember thinking like, wow, it just had like these crazy citrus complexities that, I mean, it was like this citrus, then it was this citrus, then it was that citrus. And it was like, it shifted so much, but it was so clear in its like essence of each. And it had a lot of almost like a Kenyan quality to it. I'm pretty sure it was Rwanda.
That sounds crazy.
That's even cooler. I was expecting some natural Colombia or something like that. So
what everyone uses?
Yeah. No, I'm happy to hear it's a Rwanda. That's right. Awesome.
Do you have anything else?
Yeah. You had a question about stage fright. Up
oh,
there.
Yeah.
I want you to ask.
I sometimes struggle with like public speaking. So is this something you struggle with or are you kind of a natural at it?
I mean, I would say that in the beginning, I was like, oh man, I've never really had practice with public speaking in my life, but I felt comfortable behind a counter, you know? So practicing, I was like, okay, I'm going to try to like carry a full conversation while I'm doing a bunch of things with my hands. And that was like kind of where I could focus on like, okay, I'm not just like gonna stop and look down at my work. I'm gonna be like much more present. And I think that really helps prepare yourself for stage fright. Mm-hmm. I think when the lights go on, I just kind of go in the moment. And there have been definitely competitions where I feel like I'm in a dream and I don't feel like it's me and my body anymore. I feel like total like out of body experience. And I'm like, you know, like crazy music in the background, like in a movie, you know? And I think your soundtrack is also really helpful in that way of getting you in the zone. You know, it's about tailoring to the experience of the judges as well, but it's also about giving yourself just a little bit of comfort and something to kind of like have in the background. Cause as a judge, you really don't pay attention to the music. And I think it really is about it for the competitor. But I think as far as stage fright, kind of like just thinking of people as customers helps. I've actually been like crazy nervous about doing like run-throughs in front of people that I know personally. I'm like, oh my God, I'm sweating profusely. I'm like choking up. Like my fiance, the first time that she sat in on one of my run-throughs, I like was so red and I was like, this is so embarrassing. Like, and Austin and Tim were like laughing. They're like, you don't get like this nervous for anyone. And she makes you nervous. And I was just like, I think I just need a stranger here, like, or somebody in the industry that I don't know very well, you know, to kind of have like a little bit more of a professional setting kind of take over in my mind.
Yeah. Definitely know some like baristas that are kind of like introverted, but then once they're on bar, on register, it just like completely switches and they're like a complete different person. They're happy, like talking a lot. And it's a weird thing to see, especially when you know this person outside of work and they're super extrovert or introvert and then they just switch. Is that kind of what you're talking about? Like you have this like mental switch where you're, okay, they're the customer, I'm the barista, you know, you kind of put on that different like mask kind of thing.
In a way, I think even when I'm on bar now, I find myself like talking about competition, talking about coffee in ways that are similar. So I feel like I'm just like, all right, I'm like, I'm just talking about coffee, right? But I'm much more like scripted. And I think sometimes it's less about following the script to a T. For me, I have more success in like hitting my points and like kind of understanding the bigger picture of like, okay, well, what am I doing next? Let's talk about it. You know, what do I need to make sure they know? And in the same way that you might describe a drink, or if you've ever like poured a pour over for a customer, it's like, well, are you going to stand there and like just tune out for 4 minutes? Or are you going to be like, what do you have going on after this? Like, what are you doing today? Or have you had our coffee before? Well, this coffee is from here. And like, and sometimes they might have questions. And so like in the competition stage, they're not talking back to you. So that's a little bit like intimidating, right? But they are told to smile at you and give you like a really good face. So it's sometimes like, that's like a helpful thing where like you feel like they're rooting for you. Cause I, as a judge, I think like that has helped me like understand, like, you don't need to be nervous. Like it's, I'm like, it's just me, you know, like I'm not, as a judge, I'm like, I'm not anyone that needs to you to be nervous for, you know? And I also think in my mind, like I've always been like, well, if I'm worried about something, the act of worrying doesn't help the result, because worrying is not helping the solution. It's not helping solve anything. So for me, getting nervous or like getting in the mindset of being nervous or having anxiety and that, like, even thinking about it, it's just like, all right, well, what do I need to get done? In the same way of like a shop, right? Like, you know, the stakes are low. Like somebody just wants a cup of coffee. Like you shouldn't be necessarily nervous all the time, but sometimes you have like a cute customer and you're like, oh my gosh, they're very intimidating, or like, you know, what have you. But some people have served celebrities. I've not served a celebrity. I'm waiting for my day, but I'm like, hey, if you're listening, come to Tucson and I'll serve.
Yeah, does Tucson even have celebrities? I don't know.
Right?
It's a little mountain town.
Probably cycling celebrities, but.
Yeah. I had a question here. What was your favorite routine you ever did, and why? And maybe favorite coffee too, that you got to compete with.
I would say my 2016 competition with La Palma was the first time I used La Palma, and I just had such a fun time brewing it. And I felt very connected to that coffee. And I felt like it was something people hadn't seen before in the competition level. So I felt like it was, I remember like advancing to the top six and I was just like, oh my gosh, like here I am. Like, this is what I've wanted. Like, it just felt like I had answered all the questions. And even that was like a relatively simple routine, you know? And it was just kind of like keeping it really simple. Like I used the Kalita. I didn't use a Melodrip. I, you know, had my good old Bonavita kettle, you know, like it was a simpler time. And I feel like that one was a memorable one. And I think that was my favorite, because I feel like I like checked all the boxes that I wanted to check, and the coffee really performed. And I don't think looking back, I would have done anything differently in that routine. There's been, you know, a handful of routines after that I felt like, oh, the coffee was there and the routine was not, you know, like I didn't serve my coffee the year after that. And I'm like, man, the coffee was there. Like it was so good. But yeah, the 2016, it was a natural geisha, and it was really cool because the La Palma hadn't had a natural at that point. They weren't able to do naturals because the humidity in Colombia and their region was just not, you know, it was 90% humidity all the time. So they had this like crazy El Nino year, and they were kind of like, oh man, like, what are we going to do with these coffees? And so they took a risk and they did a natural, and it was beautiful. I mean, it was just so clean and complex. I remember I called like a melon note, and like some days it would be like cantaloupe, other days it would be watermelon. Like it was so unique. It was really cool. So that was definitely my most memorable and favorite routine.
That's amazing to frame in that time. I mean, naturals coming out of Colombia were not a thing yet at all. So that was super unique at that point in 2016. And La Palma really wasn't a thing at that point either. I mean, that was kind of the start of their journey to the top. But I remember 2015, 2016, when those first lactic acid coffees, what they were calling them, were coming out, and seeing them, and I was like, what? Who are these guys? This coffee's very different and very interesting, but it's amazing thinking about it now, like how small they were at that point. So how did you get in touch with them initially?
It was the year before going to Seattle, going to Nationals, getting a chance to cup with them at Zocca. It's a coffee importer, I think. They brought them in, and I remember Austin, Tim, and I cupped those coffees, and they just wanted feedback. I don't even think they were trying to sell those coffees yet. These were just like, this is our first harvest. We're doing these new things. Like, we want to know, like, and they kind of explained the processing a little bit. And we were just like, this is like crazy beautiful. I remember thinking like, there's a lot of apples on the table, like different kinds of apples, you know, like varying acidity, but all really sweet, all really clean, all really well balanced. And, you know, I felt like up until that point, it was like natural, like blueberry, grape, Ethiopia, or, you know, a very like crisp washed central, you know, and, you know, Panama Geisha, and, you know, everyone's using 90 plus and Alita and stuff like that. So to have these like kind of fall somewhere in between, but be like so dynamic and interesting was really nice. And so I kind of was like, I think poking at Austin come competition. And I was like, can we get those, you know, like, can we? Cause the year before we had just kind of like went with, you know, a Panama Geisha that everyone was using. And it was just like, man, it wasn't even a good geisha. It was just like, it was called Segunda. And that means second in Spanish. It was like somebody's seconds, you know, like I was like, ugh. But it was, you know, it was what we got at that point, which was great. But, you know, so I remember like at that competition at the national level, they were there. La Palma was there. So more so than just like having an incredible routine, like I got to like meet them and like brew their coffee and serve them their coffee. And like, I remember their agronomist was like, that is a geisha, you know? And it was just like, I was like, dang, like that feels good, you know? But it was interesting because during that routine, they had a booth because it was SCA, and they were cupping, like they had people come by and cup. And so I attended the cupping, but they also like had asked me to brew like samples of their coffee for people. And I was like, oh yeah, definitely. And so they had this new coffee on the table, and it was a natural cedra. And I mean, we cupped that and we were like, holy, should we just scrap this routine and like get this coffee? And I was like, no, we can't. So it was just like it was kind of a happenstance, because then that was the coffee. After that routine, that was in May, I went, Austin was like, you need to go see the farm. And so he sent me for 2 weeks, and they had like a almost like an international like barista program where like you go for a week, you learn everything that they do at the farm, and then you go to Bogota. They have a cafe, Libertario, and you work with their baristas. You give them some of your knowledge, you know? And so it was incredible. And I cupped the cedra again there at the farm level against like a geisha and like, you know, SL28s, which is awesome to have an SL28 in Colombia. Is just really crazy. And that cedra was like phenomenal, so complex, so unique. And I was like, oh, can we get that for next competition? You know, I was like so stoked. And so that was the year that the bracket got filled up. So then I just froze that coffee that year, because I was like, I love that coffee. So it was just kind of like all leading into the next, you know, portion of competition, my journey with coffee and like my experience with their coffee. But that 2016 routine was just like such a standout for me.
That's an awesome story. Thanks for telling that.
It's crazy. I'm like, was that my life? Like, that's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's super cool. And what's funny is that year that the bracket filled up, I remember you not making it in. And I remember you must have put a post up or something, and we were like super sad.
I was bummed.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember. And I was bummed. I was like, oh, this is so sad. But that was the year you judged, right? For the first time. And you actually judged. Did you judge Kim Hawk at that point? And
yeah.
Yeah. So you were our judge at that point, because I was just helping Kim Hawk. And so we kind of met you during that. And I thought that was so fun seeing you there and then getting you judge and getting to hear your feedback at the end. I remember I came there and we were super young in the coffee, I think at that point, like a year in. That was the first Brewers Cup and he gave us all this advice and it was a really fun.
I definitely, you know, I was like very aware of like my presence on the judging panel because I felt like years prior there was, you know, really like older esteemed judges that had been doing the same for years and years. And I was like, you know, I felt like there was definitely some people like looking like, what's she doing up there? You know, and it was just like, you can be here too, you know, like, but I tried very much to be, you know, subjective with past competitors that I had competed alongside. And I almost felt like it was an honorable thing for me to be able to like judge their routines. Like it was a big job. And I felt like it had to be treated as such and with respect. And I felt like, I remember Kim Hawk having, I think he was really nervous that year, but I remember his coffee and it was a blend and it was so good. Yeah. And I mean, he is one of the brewers that I also think too, like he brews a beautiful cup of coffee. Like no matter what it is, it is so enhanced by his brewing.
Yeah, definitely.
Is that when he did like a full immersion kind of brewer?
No, he did the St. Anthony's. Yeah. Really interesting looking because it doesn't even look like there's anything holding the filter. It's like, oh my God, it's going to come right out the fry. It's going to spill his coffee everywhere. And it didn't. And I was just like, wow, that's kind of cool. Like,
yeah, that was a really fun year. That one was our first one. And, you know, we were such a new company at that point. And the blend was really a economic choice. You know, we couldn't go out and spend something like crazy to get some awesome coffee. But we did have a El Brahe Geisha at the time. They were serving for the holidays. Las Lajas natural that was like really fruity. And then we had our family coffees from Brazil and he wanted to like mesh the three flavor profiles in a unique way. And I thought that was it's actually really cool.
Yeah, I think it actually can give you a, you know, I think people think of blend as muddled or like, you know, balancing out. And I think if it's done well, you can really, you can improve cup score across the board, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. There's no way to get that super floral, citric, geisha like quality and natural, like super blueberry, winey kind of feelings in the same cup without some sort of blend or some really crazy coffee, but much easier to do it with a blend. So if you could do it right.
I mean, it had a really good body.
Yeah, the Brazil coming in there with the body, it was his idea there too. So it was, okay. Yeah, that was a fun. Yeah, that was a fun year. Definitely nervous though, first times being up there. But yeah, that was awesome. Actually, what do you think? So speaking on that a little bit, I don't think I've ever seen anyone really use blends anywhere in competition. Do they get judged differently in your eyes? Like, why do people not do that? Is it a perception thing?
I mean, my coworker, Monica, from Augie's did a blend last year. She did a washed and a natural Ethiopia, which I thought was really fun. And it was her first competition too. So it was real sweet to like be able to coach her through it. But I think like, again, it comes down to execution. I don't think, you know, for the most part as a judge, like you're really not supposed to have the influence of like, this coffee is a Panama Geisha, so it's going to taste good. But however, if you are surprised at a Sumatra tasting like a Panama Geisha, that's a unique thing. Like that's to be rewarded. That's not like, you know, that's taking something unusual and making it great, you know, or in this case, a blend. You know, I think it's, if you can execute a blend to taste like a really high scoring single origin, I think that's a really strong move. And I think it shows in the cup and it shows in the scores. You know, it's not meant to be about preference. It's meant to be about what is actually happening in the cup. So.
Awesome. Well, I think that we've asked you about all the questions. Do you have anything else, Eddie?
I mean, I was going to ask if there was any possibility of you competing in the future, but we kind of touched on that. You need to kind of make a comeback.
I got my whole reputation is on the line, you know? I think I feel like, you know, coming up to the plate every single year, and getting a little bit closer and having things to work on and things like that, there kind of became a point of diminishing return where I was feeling like I was giving up so much of my free time and my mental capacity and, you know, emotional labor and everything like that to devote so much of the year. You know, this is not a week, you know, this is not a month. This is putting yourself through this because you want to do well. You want to win every time. If you're not going to win, I mean, some people aren't going to win, but I think everyone really is like trying to win. So, you know, going to bat three times a year, every year for, you know, 6 years is difficult. And I felt like I needed to just step back again and judge and kind of allow myself to still be a part of it and to give back to it and learn from it. And now that I've had, you know, even 2020 is just such a, I mean, we all know what 2020 was. So I think having that experience, having the downtime, having the headspace to come back to it was just something I needed. And I feel like I know so much more than I think I know. And I also have so much left to learn on brewing the coffee that is on the pedestal in my mind that I've had that I want, you know, to brew and to understand like extraction in a way that, you know, you can just taste and do side-by-sides and come to conclusions, but sometimes you just need to think a little bit more on what is happening and how you can improve it. And so I feel like once competition opens back up, like I would absolutely love to throw myself in the ring, you know?
Yeah.
But I mean, there's definitely a point. I think I'll always like still judge. I really enjoy it. So.
That's amazing. Kind of our closing question now that we've been given everyone is where do you see the coffee industry moving in the next 5 to 10 years? What trends do you think are going to be happening or where do you hope to see it?
I think accessibility is really huge right now. I think like being approachable and accessible on like your menu and your price point and making sure that makes sense. We kind of talked about it in the beginning, but like hitting different types of people at different times in the day, I think is really unique and important as a business model. I think for a while it was like, let's get the students in and let's give free Wi-Fi. But I think that's shifting. I think like now the thing that people have been lacking is really human connection and like having a space that you can like sit down and hang out with your friends again and have like an actual conversation. And I feel like making those spaces make sense will be where we see the future going. I think keeping things simple though is also kind of on the horizon. I think, you know, for a while it was like really simple menus, like no seasonal drinks. And then it was like seasonal drinks and it went kind of crazy. And I feel like for a lot of cafes, it was like the seasonals were pushed to the side this year. Right. And so I think it'll be about like less is more in the future. And that doesn't need to be like going back to a simplified menu, but it's like, if you are not putting out the best, it shouldn't be on your menu. And I think people would agree with that. I also see like packaging being kind of huge with roasters and like presentation being really big, having something that's going to look like really marketable and kind of changing more consistently, I think will be kind of big. Obviously, I think volumetrics on an espresso machine is going to come back. You know, I know everyone's kind of into pressure profiling and stuff like that, but again, kind of minimizing mechanics to make sense and being able to like replicate and dial into that is huge. So yeah, all of the above and more. I think I kind of see beer and wine being more present in coffee shops. I know natural wines are like a huge thing right now. And I know a lot of specialty folks that really like it and want to include that on their bars. And yeah, I think as more and more people start appreciating that side of things, like we're seeing similarities in processing for coffees, like things that we're taking a page from winemakers' books, you know, in terms of adding yeast and, you know, fermenting for longer periods of time and temperature control. On the growing side of things, I think like it will be more about process and less about varietal. It'll be about more coffees that are higher producing and higher yielding that you can enhance the cup profile through processing. I think that's already on trend. And I think that's only going to improve everyone's livelihoods, you know? So I don't know. I as much as I want to predict these things, I'm like, what makes sense? What, like sometimes I feel like we can barely see around the corner to things that are happening. But I think in terms of like cafe settings, like it's going to be just a little bit more elevated, I think, going forward. Just my thought.
Both elevated in quality and easier at the same time, which is that's a good couple things to do in unison. I hope that we can get there.
What do you think is on trend? Do you have any thoughts?
Oh, a lot of the stuff you said there, for sure. Yeah, I think, I mean, on the farm level, what you said is right on with what I see, like these Timor hybrid varieties, but then with enhanced processing to make them really good. So really high yield and disease resistant, and lots of notes from winemakers, because why would we not be looking to the people that have been fermenting fruit for hundreds of years for inspiration when we've been doing it for like a year or two, you know, in coffee, or maybe 5 years, where we've really been trying to focus on it. So I think we'll be taking a lot from wine. I think that's going to be big. I think processing for sure is going to go all over the place. I think we're going to see a lot of new stuff in that. And we're already seeing, like, I see new stuff every single harvest cycle that I'm just like, I would have never thought of that, or this is mind blowing in some new way. So definitely that, I see that trend just continuing and getting cooler and cooler. Yeah, cafes are hard for me to predict though, because I mean, this last year,
I think people are missing that connection though.
Connection
with
yeah.
their barista or whoever's serving them coffee. Like a lot of people would go into a shop and like they showed, like they'd go in there and they were comfortable with the barista. They knew them, they were close. And now 2020 kind of just took that all away. So I think that's definitely going to come back, and the shop is going to be a little bit more of a safe haven kind of thing in 2021.
Yeah. Centers of community, hopefully.
Yeah.
That's I would love to see that come back, because everyone needs a little bit of that right now. So
yeah. Do you think we'll ever see a really amazing home espresso setup that's affordable?
Oh man, I would love that.
No, it's all expensive.
It's all very expensive. Yeah, I don't think you can make grinders and a machine that's going to be like good and under $1,000, but I sure hope so.
Think about TVs and how far they've come, right? And their price.
True.
Like, I mean.
I hope, yeah.
If you think, I don't know, but I feel like I get the question a lot. Like, what's a good, I want to do this at home, you know, especially now. It's like, you know, nobody really, not everyone can spend $5,000-$6,000 on a perfect home machine and a grinder. I certainly can't. I would love something in like the 1 to 2 range for that, you know?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think you could do pretty well at $1,000, you know, right now. If espresso, like an amazing setup, got around $500, I think you'd see a lot of people get into that. But yeah, it's...
Then they would take our jobs away. I don't know. No.
yeah, a little bit.
Whatever. No. People still go out to eat and they can cook at home, you know?
It's true.
Yeah, true. Yeah, you go for the spectacle a little bit and the uniqueness.
Laziness, maybe.
The laziness, yeah. Maybe a little bit.
For me, like, I know for coffee, like, coffee just tastes so much better when somebody else makes it for you.
Yeah, yeah.
It's what it is, but I'm just like, wow.
You don't have to judge every second of it. I think that helps for me. You still do a little bit, but.
It depends. I mean, you're always, like, thinking about what's happening. If you're watching somebody make it, but if you're not, it's just there, then.
Yeah, definitely. What do you think about automation in the shop while I have you?
I think it's smart. I think technology has come a long way. It's not like garbage in, garbage out. You know, it's like if you can have one variable eliminated, right? Like, you know that your shot needs to pull in this amount of time and this amount of, or like as grinders improve, the doses improve. Then if you have the water doses improved, then you're just eliminating a lot of things that can happen wrong, and you're still allowing a good extraction. So I don't think there's any harm in it. You know, I think I remember, you know, at Augie's when we decided to go from manual pour overs to a Seraphim, and that was, you know, the baristas were like, oh my God, like you're taking the craft out of my job. And I was like, the craft wasn't there when you started a pour over and then had to go tell somebody about that pastry for 5 minutes. You can't predict how long that interaction is going to be. So there's something being sacrificed. You're sacrificing the interaction to the person, and you're sacrificing the coffee that somebody spent $5-6 on. I mean, I remember like what did it for me. I think the tipping point was seeing a customer reach over the bar and grab the kettle and start pouring. And
oh,
I was
my
like,
God.
Such a like scary moment. I was like, we can't do this anymore. Like, no, so it's like, there's only so much people will wait. And I think, you know, if there's attention to detail elsewhere and it can be replicated, people will appreciate that just as much. If you put the time into like making sure your recipe is great, making sure your water is great, your equipment is cleaned, like do that, you know, like making sure that roast is on point, you know, clean out your grinders, you know, just like do the little things that like nobody, you know, necessarily wants to do, but makes actually like a big difference.
Yeah. Is there a limit for you? So if the whole cafe automated espresso machine, completely auto, the brewers all auto, and you're just like a server, would you like that kind of setup, or is that too much?
I guess I would have to be living in it, but I mean, I think I still like really enjoy like working on register. You know what I mean? I think that's still like in a service mode, you know, and I don't necessarily need to get my hands like dirty the whole time to feel like I'm giving somebody an experience and a beverage that they want, you know. That being said, I mean, who doesn't love pouring a latte? Like, you know, it's like the best when somebody's like, you just like nail it and you hand it to them and they're like, they get out there and like, I love that, you know.
Yeah,
that's something for me that'll never get old. So, and I think for people, it won't either. And I think that human element of like somebody like mastered that, like that's beautiful, is still very much prioritized.
Totally agree. Yeah. So I think that's pretty much all our questions. If there's anywhere people want to follow you or find you, is there somewhere you want to shout out?
Yeah. I mean, Instagram, the Blairista, you know, my tried
and true handle.
Yeah, that's about it. I don't do Twitter. I'll like watch TikTok, but I won't create yet. Yeah, usually if you want to find me, just Instagram is still like the best way.
Real quick, is there an archive of past Brewers Cups routines that people could watch so they could go and find stuff you've done, or did they wipe that?
I think they wiped it. I the other day to show like a coworker and I could not find a single one.
Yeah, I was trying to do the same thing. I couldn't find them anywhere. So
it's like uscoffeechamps.org, and then you just participate, like watch, and there's a live stream link, but the live stream link didn't really go anywhere.
Really?
Maybe YouTube if I like search real hard, but.
Well, I'll do a little searching around, see if I can find a routine of yours and throw it up on there.
There's two I know that were in existence. They're very embarrassing.
Definitely put those up.
Yeah.
For sure.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Blair. This was a deep dive into all things Brewers Cup. I thought that was a ton of fun.
With me, it was great.
Yeah, I'll have to do this again sometime. Have to hopefully see you soon when maybe the communities open up. We'll plan something.
When it's a little safer, you know, the Arizona especially is not doing well right now.
No, not at all.
Hiding out in my bunker over here. Working home. I get my groceries delivered. I'm not messing around.
Nice. Yeah, about the same for me. So hopefully when that fixes, we'll see you soon. Have a great night. It's great seeing you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you want to hear more, please subscribe in any of the places you listen to podcasts. For more information and where to follow us, please check out the show notes. Thank you.